Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there while you're in the quarantine. You might have time to listen to things. Even though I've seen statistics, not our statistics per se, but nationwide or worldwide statistics that say podcasting numbers are a little bit down in the quarantine. And I was trying to figure that out. I was like, really? That's odd. Now, our numbers, because you guys are the faithful, are not down. But overall, over the podcasting industry, they are down. And then it occurred to me, oh, I know why that is. People aren't commuting. This is the problem. People are not commuting to work. And this is when most people listen to podcasts. But not you guys. You'll listen no matter what. So thanks for that. But if you're looking for other podcasts to listen to, because maybe you decided to do one of those home projects. Man, I drove by Home Depot just yesterday, Chad. That place was packed. There was no social distance. There's no way that those people were 10 feet apart or 6 feet apart or whatever. That parking lot was completely full. It was nice outside, and everyone decided they were going to get that honey-do list done while they were in quarantine, and that's the way it's been going. Maybe that's you. Maybe you, like, planted a garden. Maybe you built a stand-up garden. Maybe it's time to build the shed, whatever. Remodel the house. You're going to need some podcasts to listen to. This one's not going to be long enough. It's only 40 minutes a week. That's not enough. You can't get anything done in 40 minutes. Go check out some of those other podcasts, see if one of them suits your fancy. But what numbers are up everywhere are video numbers, Chad. People, when they're sitting around, they don't want to just listen. A lot of times they want to get their eyes involved. They want to get more senses involved. Apparently, we got you covered. Chad's doing a video a week now. And if you haven't checked those out, you should. He's doing the gospel through Old Testament eyes. That's what he's doing. And you can get those videos on Facebook, or you can just go over to YouTube and watch those videos. You can watch the new series that I did with Scott Keith and Caleb Keith on the Forum of Concord. And just out, it's coming out now. The first video is out, and more videos are coming out. Chad Bird, myself, and Scott going over the Decalogue. I think we're doing 11 different videos on the Decalogue. And it might be a little different than you think. We're not just, you know, just talking about here's what you should do and here's what you shouldn't do. But we're going all over the place in the Decalogue. So check those out. Those are actually, those two series are only available on YouTube. So if you're one of those people that's like, yeah, I'm really into watching content right now. I'm really into using my eyeballs right now and not just my ears because I'm not on that commute anymore. Go to the 1517 on YouTube and hit subscribe and you'll have access to every video we've ever done. Well, Chad, no events to talk about because we still don't know what's going on.
No, just get up in the morning, drink coffee, go to work in my study.
That's it.
That's my events of the day.
Yes. Yes. It's a very uneventful time that we're having here. I imagine this is going to result, we'll see, in a very packed 2021 because I feel like people are going to be ready to go, ready to hold events, ready to get out there and mix it up with people. So we'll see. I hope that's the case, because even I, who am used to being home, who doesn't mind being by themselves, I'm like, it wouldn't kill me to be around some other people at this point. So we're hoping. And, you know, we're obviously hoping that Here We Still Stand is a thing. You know, we're still holding out. All right. Today, we sort of touched on Samson a little bit. Not really Samson, hardly at all. Mostly Samson's mother, and a messenger who's more than an angel. Last week, now I think we're going to get right into the thick of it.
Yeah, we are. We got through the first 7 verses of Judges chapter 13, where we are introduced to the parents of soon to be born Samson. We don't know his mom's name. For some reason, she is left anonymous. We do know his dad's name, Manoah. And we're going to hear a little bit more about him today. What we know so far is that the Philistines are the bad guys in this particular story. Bad guys being the current oppressors of Israel. You know, it kind of goes back and forth between different groups. But pretty much from, I think I mentioned this in the last podcast, pretty much from here all the way through the time of King David, the arch enemies of Israel, the ones that just kind of, you know, keep giving them problems, are going to be the Philistines. And that's the situation that we're in now. In fact, it's been that way for about four decades. For the last 40 years, the Philistines have been oppressing the Israelites one way or another. But it seems as if, judging at least by the way that the story of Samson unfolds, it seems as if the Israelites and the Philistines have kind of come to a sort of a peaceful coexistence, you might say. Because anytime that Samson causes problems in these stories with the Philistines, the Israelites are like, dude, no, just, you know, take it easy. Don't cause problems. Don't make waves. So it seems as if the Israelites have just kind of settled down into this coexistence with the Philistines.
I mean, Samson definitely seems like a different kind of judge in the sense that he acts alone a lot. Where the other judges, they show up and then they rally the people. They rally some, either, you know, the people or some group of people, and they go and take care of business. His is more sabotage and, you know, under cover of night, you're going in, like he's like a, you know, like a special forces guy that's going in there and just wreaking havoc all the time. And his is sort of a prolonged thing, right? He's like chipping away at the Philistines. And he's not able to do the sort of thing where he just rallies the nation behind him to overthrow the oppressor, because they're kind of like, I don't know, man, it's not that bad. Like, it's
Yeah, he's different in so many ways from a lot of the other judges. I mean, he's kind of a loner. He's kind of a rebel. He's kind of he is a one-man army. But everything that you kind of pick up about his personality, it seems like he's just kind of one of those guys that does his own thing and doesn't really want to have anything to do with anybody kind of being on his team. I'm sure there were many factors that led to that particular approach, but yeah, he's definitely not your typical like military leader like Gideon was or any of the other judges.
Well, as someone, and we've mentioned this, and not to get away from his dad, which we'll get into in a second, but I think part of this is, you know, we've mentioned that Samson is probably the most Christological of all the judges. So it would make sense that he's also the judge that sort of delivers on his own,
right? Yeah.
This is a very Christ-like move. I mean, Christ, I don't know if you guys know this, but he doesn't get a lot of help when it comes to overthrowing sin, death, and the devil. This is something he does all by himself.
Yeah. We're always trying to give him a helping hand there. it's unneeded and unwanted.
In fact, when he's like, maybe we should overthrow these things that are oppressing you, we would definitely be the people to be like, I don't know about that. I mean, there's not that bad.
Right. I kind of like my sin, right? Yeah. So, that's going to be one characteristic of Samson that emerges very quickly in his life. We got to get him born first. So let's see what happens here. So all we know so far is that the Moloch Yahweh, the messenger of the Lord, appeared to a woman. I don't know her name. And told her that she was going to have a child. She had been unable to conceive children up to this point, she and her husband. So this is another one of those many stories through the scriptures where God is appearing to a wife that wants to have children and cannot, and announces that, in fact, she will. So there's all sorts of these kind of annunciations in the Old Testament, all of which are, of course, leading up to the annunciation of the angel to the Virgin Mary. But anyway, this is another one of these. But this one is a little bit different because not only is she told that she's going to have a son, but that he is going to be a Nazarite, not a temporary Nazarite, as were most Nazarites in the Old Testament, but a lifelong Nazarite, beginning already in the womb, indeed. So his mother herself cannot have any wine or beer or anything like that. I know pregnant mothers shouldn't drink, but this is like laid down as a law for her, because what she takes, the child's going to take. So from the moment of conception on, he's supposed to remain free from all that. And then when he grows up, of course, no cutting of the hair, no visits to the barber for Samson. And that's basically all that she is told. And the angel appears to her when she's by herself. She's out in the field when this happens. So she never says anything to this messenger. She doesn't respond. She goes back and tells her husband what he said. And at this point, it doesn't seem as if she, or as we'll see in a minute, or her husband actually know who this is. It comes across to me, judging from the way the story unfolds, that they think it's just some maybe prophet, something like that. We're told who he is. But when she reports this to her husband, she says, "A man of God came to me, and his appearance was like the appearance of the angel of God." Very awesome. So maybe they suspect, but they don't know yet. They're going to find out relatively soon. Anyway, she relates with a little bit of the parts edited out, but relates basically what the messenger told her to her husband. And then we pick it up here with verse 8. So how does her husband, Manoah, react to all this? Well, he prays. So it's a good place to start. He prays to the Lord and says, "Oh Lord, please let the man of God," again, no reference to him being a messenger, a divine messenger, "just please let the man of God, the one that you sent to us, come again so that he can teach us what to do for the boy who is to be born." Now, this is a little bit strange because they've already been told. I mean, the mother now has already been told what they are to do for the boy. So, but anyway, Manoah wants to find out more. So, and God says, listens to the voice of Manoah. So he's going to answer his prayer. And so once again, the angel makes a visit, and he once again just comes to the woman while she's by herself. Manoah's not with her. She's sitting in the field. And so as soon as he shows up, she runs home and says, "The guy is here again. Behold, the man who came the other day has appeared to me." So they both go out there to meet him. And Manoah strikes up the conversation. He says, "Are you the man who spoke to the woman?" And he responds just with one word. It's the word, first person personal pronoun, I, ani. It's not the great I am that we usually think of with the divine name, but just ani. It's real short, real brief. He just says, "I." And Manoah says, "Now, when your words come to pass, what shall be the boy's..." And here we have a translation issue. So this is verse 12. Manoah is wondering what shall be the boy's mishpat and doings. Now, mishpat is the word that's usually translated as justice or judgment. And sometimes it's translated here as mode of life. What I'm looking at, the ESV. And the ESV has, "Now, what is to be the child's manner of life, and what is his mission?" Wow, that's quite a translation. So, manner of life and mission. The New American Standard has "what is to be his mode of life and his vocation." So, mission and vocation—that's not too bad for the second word. I mean, it's just literally, what is his deeds? What's he supposed to do? What's he going to be doing? And the first part, mishpat, I don't think that's referring to a mode of life. I think that's like, would you explain a little bit more what this announcement was, this decree concerning this child? I think that's really what that's talking about, but it's a little bit ambiguous. And mishpat is one of those words that you can take several different directions.
I mean, but anyway, it kind of seems like the simplest way maybe to understand this, maybe I'm wrong, is if somebody told you like this incredible thing was going to happen, you might ask why.
Yeah, right.
Why? So give birth to a son, and then we got to make sure that he does, you know, that he doesn't have any drink and he doesn't cut his hair. What's up?
Yeah,
I mean, that's how it reads to me, is that you're saying, can I get a little clarification on like why us? Why can't he do like this? Seems like there's more to this than just, you're going to have a son and make sure this stuff doesn't happen. Okay, see ya. And you're like, yeah. Wait.
Yeah. I think you're right. I mean, it would be the natural reaction of any parent, right? Yeah. I mean, when you have this, you can't have children, and then all of a sudden you're going to have children, and it happens because this strange character shows up and tells you, you want to know more, you know, what's going on? Why are we doing all this? So, he's going to find out. He's going to answer him. He says, well, his response is kind of funny. Verse 13 says, let the woman pay attention to all that I said. So I'm like, I've already told you. She shouldn't eat anything that comes from the vine or drink wine or beer nor any unclean thing. And let her observe that all that I commanded. So he's not going to throw the hair cutting part in here because he's already mentioned that. So in other words, on top of being basically a faithful Israelite eating kosher, then make sure that you don't have a glass of wine after dinner or a beer on Saturday night, and don't be eating, any non-kosher foods. Then Manoah responds again. He wants this guy to stay for dinner, basically. He says, please let us detain you so that we may prepare a goat for you. And I don't think that he has in mind a sacrifice at this point. He's just like, hey, this is a pretty special event. So we're going to take a goat from the herd and we're going to have a barbecue. But the messenger of the Lord responds, basically, no, though you detain me, I will not eat your food. And this is not because these particular appearances of the messenger cannot involve meals. Remember way back in Genesis when the three visited Abraham, prepared this whole feast for him, right? And they sat there eating and drinking with Abraham and his family. So whatever the reason is, he's not going to do it here. He's not going to have dinner with Manoah and his wife. But he says, if you want to do something like that, here's what you need to do. You just get a burnt offering prepared and offer it to Yahweh. And it says Manoah did not know that he was the Malach Yahweh. He didn't know he was the messenger of the Lord. So he then asked him what his name is. So Manoah says, the angel of the Lord. Well, this is kind of funny. It's almost comes across in the Hebrew as if he's a little bit flabbergasted because the guy won't stay for dinner. Because literally in the Hebrew, it's not what is your name, it's who is your name, which is not the way that you ask this in Hebrew. I mean, no one asks who is your name. It's not like it's some Hebrew idiom. In Hebrew, you say, what is your name? You don't say, who is your name? So maybe Manoah was just a little bit rattled by this response. But whatever it was, he says, who is your name? So that when your words come to pass, we may honor you. I'm wondering, I could be totally off base here, but I'm wondering if he wants to know his name so that maybe they could name their child after him. I don't know. It's just pure speculation on my part. But when he says that we may honor you, I mean, what kind of honoring does he have in mind? Maybe it's just a giving of thanks to God, or maybe it's something else. Whatever it is, he's not going to find out. Because the messenger responds, why do you ask my name, seeing it is wonderful? Now, this word for wonderful is found in various places in the Old Testament. So you're all familiar around Christmas time, the reading from Isaiah 9, where you hear about the wonderful counselor, mighty God, everlasting Father, so on and so forth. The word that's used there for wonderful is the same word that's used here, a form of the same word that's used here for wonderful. So there's a tie in there between that passage in Isaiah about the Messiah and this particular figure who is the Son of God, the Word of God, the messenger of the Father. And there's also a tie in with the very next verse. It says, Manoah took the goat with the grain offering. He offered it on the rock to the Lord who works wonders. That's one possible way to translate that. That word for wonders is the same root word that he just said was connected to his name. So this wonderfully named messenger is right there while the God who works wonders does his thing while Manoah and his wife looks on. I almost forgot. Interestingly, the same word is used, and I have to think it's on purpose. Psalm 139, where you have the passage about God, crafting me, weaving me together in the womb. I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. That word for wonderfully, that adverb that's used there, is the same root, which is kind of interesting because we've just had a birth announcement, right?
Right, right.
And there's a child that's now in the womb. And so for Psalm 139 to pick up on that same word and use it to describe God's activity of shaping children in the womb, it just makes me wonder if, like, when David was writing that psalm, if he was not actually meaning for us to kind of make a connection way back here to Judges chapter 13. But anyway, whatever the reason is, what happens is when they offer this goat, we have this kind of a wild scene that takes place, because a flame goes up from the altar toward heaven when the sacrifice is offered. And the angel of the Lord, the messenger of the Lord, ascends in the flame of the altar while Manoah and his wife were looking on. And so they quite naturally fall on their faces to the ground. And then it says, just kind of summarize the rest of the story, he didn't appear any more to them. And Manoah now knows that it was the messenger of Yahweh. And this is kind of a funny exchange. So Manoah says to his wife, "We're dead. We shall surely die because we've seen God." And I just love his wife's response. He's like completely panicking here. But his wife is like being very logical. She's like, "Listen, husband, if the Lord wanted to kill us, he would not have accepted our offering. And if he wanted to kill us, he wouldn't have shown us all these things. And if he wanted to kill us, he wouldn't have let us hear things like this. So it'll be all right. God's not going to come down here and smite us just because we've seen his messenger."
And this response is sort of the definitive part of knowing that you've not just encountered an angel, but you've encountered God. He doesn't say, You know, "God's going to kill us, we've seen an angel." He says, we've seen God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, they're sure now. And I suspect, as messed up as Israel was at this point, everybody still knew who the Malach Yahweh was. It wasn't just a created angel, but it was God manifesting himself. And of course, this is, if you're a longtime listener to the podcast, you know, many times we've talked about this messenger of the Lord shows up, first of all, in Genesis 16 to Hagar, shows up in Exodus 3, Exodus 23, here in Judges 13. Jacob speaks about him on his deathbed to Joseph. So all over the place in the Old Testament. And I talked about this actually in the video that I was put out this morning to some extent, but there's all different ways in the Old Testament where the one God has his word or his messenger or his glory or his name. And these are the ways by which he interacts with the world. And we see this picked up in the New Testament as well, where John, of course, will talk about the Son being the Logos. Or you'll have Paul in 1 Corinthians say that Christ has become to us our wisdom. Well, he's drawing upon Proverbs when he says Christ is our wisdom from God. And there's evidence, too, that the Malach Yahweh traditions influence some of what Paul said, for instance, when he talks about the Egyptian plagues and the 10th plague and Christ being the destroyer that went through the land of Egypt. So anyway, all of this was kind of the Old Testament's way of using Trinitarian language. They didn't use Father, Son, and Holy Spirit language. I mean, they did, but not in the exact same way that we did. But this was Old Testament Trinitarian language, where you have Yahweh and you have his word, or you have his glory, you have his spirit by which he is interacting with his people.
It's interesting that the first person that the messenger of the Lord, or that Christ actually shows up to, I mean, you would think that it would be Abraham, but it's actually his servant, wife,
concubine
wife, like the Gentile, whatever's going on there. Yeah. It's interesting that that's the first person that Christ shows up to, it also makes sense. Like, well, who would Christ first show up to? Well, I don't know, probably someone out in the wilderness with no hope.
Yes, right. Yeah, and an Egyptian on top of that.
Yeah.
So it's pretty crazy the way things kind of work.
He does seem to show up that way. Yeah, and Jesus does seem to show up when everything is hopeless.
Yes,
that's when he shows up.
Yeah. Right. She's also the only one in the Old Testament who names God. She calls him El Roy, the God who sees. So it's a pretty powerful testimony to the fact that God has his eye especially locked on people who think that God has abandoned them, which I'm sure was where she was at. I mean, she was in a pretty bad place.
What's interesting is that they ask his name and he won't say. Meanwhile, someone like, you know, Hagar is gives God a name. Doesn't ask. He just gives God a name, and we have no reason to think he doesn't sort of accept that name.
Yeah, I love that name. Yeah, but it's because, you know, she felt like she was blind to God, right? Like, I mean, a lot of people feel unseen. Like, nobody really, like, if they were to disappear, that no one would miss them. Or if they were to die, that no one would really pay any attention. They just, you know, kind of a, just not that significant an individual. So they feel unseen in that way. So that's why I always love that particular story from Genesis to point people to that. Say, listen, you're not unseen. You have Elroy. You have the God who sees. He's looking at you. He's got his eye on you because he is especially connected to people who are just at their wits' end.
Yeah, you sort of see, this is, I know this is like, it seems like it's way off the track here, but yeah, I whenever I hear that, I always think about Jesus talking about how God's eye is on the sparrow. I almost feel like it's an embracing, I mean, because it's an embracing of this name, right? Where it's like, I'm the God who sees everything. Like, I see, like, a sparrow doesn't fall to the ground without me knowing it.
Yeah. One of my favorite quotes in this regard is from Luther's commentary on the Magnificat. And I may have said it on the show before, but if I have, it's been a while. He's talking about Mary's song where she talks about God noticing his maidservant. And he says that God always looks down because there's no one above him. And there's no one beside him. There's no one his equal. So he always looks down. And the farther away from God one is, the better he can see you. It's just great.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful vision because, in other words, if you're trying to like exalt yourself and climb up to heaven and get close to God, he can't see very well. But the farther you are in the depths, the better he sees you. Always love that image of Luther from the Magnificat.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Very encouraging. Okay. So all of that is a good aside from what we're talking about here with the appearance of this messenger of the Lord, Christ, to these people. Okay, so pick up the story. What happens next? Well, what you think would happen? We have a birthday. We have a nativity. Verse 24 says, the woman gave birth to a son, and she named him, well, we call him Samson, but if we were speaking Hebrew, we would call him Shimshon, which is a pretty cool name, too. It's weird, these... you might wonder, I mean, I have, like, okay, if it's Shimshon in the Hebrew, how in the world do we get Samson, right? Well, I think almost every biblical name, it worked like this. I mean, not all of them. Some of them are basically just transliterated. But usually what happened is the Hebrew was translated into Greek, and the Greek influenced the Latin, and it's from the Greek and the Latin that we get our English names. So, you know, languages make some changes in sounds and in vowels and stuff like that. So most of our English names came from the Hebrew, I mean, it came from the Greek and the Latin translations, Septuagint and the Vulgate. So Shimshon in Hebrew, or Samson, as we call him. He's got an interesting name because it's a diminutive form of the Hebrew word Shemesh, which is the word for sun. You have a place that's not very far, actually, from where Samson lives called Beit Shemesh or Beth Shemesh, which means house of the sun. So a little bit of speculation as to why he's named this. I mean, you can either kind of go positive or negative with it. Positively, you can kind of do the metaphor. Oh, well, Samson was born as a ray of light in darkened times. So you can kind of go the whole, you know, that positive, put the positive spin on it. Or the negative spin would be that the worship of the sun, of the Shemesh, was so prevalent in Israel that you had Israelites naming their children after this pagan god, Shemesh, which is not entirely beyond the pale of possibility given the spiritual state of Israel at this time. But
if you know anything about the life of Samson, you'd be like, how about both? It's probably both.
Yeah, yeah, maybe that's the best answer. He is a ray of light, but man, there's a lot of darkness too going on. But if you ever wonder what his name is, well, that's it. It's a diminutive form of Shemesh, of sun. So Shimshon or Samson. So what happens to him? Well, he just says he grew up and the Lord blessed him. That's the same language that's used in 1 Samuel to describe Samuel, who was raised, of course, there with Eli and and his wicked son's priest there at the tabernacle. And the Spirit of the Lord, it's verse 25, Spirit of the Lord began to stir him, it says. It's a little bit difficult to translate, but the verb there means, because it doesn't occur very often in this particular form. I mean, like, this is the same verb that's used for, like, when the king is troubled, he can't sleep, and he wakes up. So it's like God began to trouble Samson, I mean, in a good way, but, like, stir him up, you know, work on him, I guess we might say. And then it lists where this happened. It was Mahaneh Dan, between Zorah and Eshtaol. Now, we don't know. I wish we knew more about kind of the physicality of Samson. Everybody assumes he looks like Thor from the Strongest Man competition.
Right.
Yeah, he's just one of these these guys from Iceland or Greenland, wherever he's from, Iceland. You know, it's massive. But the only physical description we have of Samson is his hair. We're not told that he was, like, you know, 6'8" and 400 pounds. That's the impression you get because of his strength, but that's just kind of speculation. We really don't know how big he was. His strength came from God, not from his biceps.
Yeah, no, and like, if you get, like, a children's Bible out, he's the closest thing you have to a superhero, right?
I mean, yeah.
The way that they always draw him, you know, they present him as, yeah, it looks like, you know, he's all jacked.
Schwarzenegger,
he's all jacked up like some Marvel superhero.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it just kind of fits with our preconception. Well, I mean, if you have this kind of, in many ways, it kind of is, I don't want to say contradicting the biblical text, because maybe that's too strong, but it downplays the importance of the fact that his strength comes exclusively from God.
Well, yeah, right? I mean, look, I don't care how jacked you are, you don't get to do the things that Samson does. He was probably some, like, scrawny guy, because that's how God works. He's always working through the opposite, right? So I would assume that it's probably nothing that physically, you know, intimidating about this guy, because it makes no difference. I mean, I don't care how much you work out, you can't do the stuff that he does.
No, right. Yeah, this is beyond just pure physical strength. So anyway, that's all we know about his physicality, is he has long hair. And besides that, that's it. Now, I'll say this is a kind of preamble to the next chapter. It is kind of interesting. You maybe think of this when you mention superheroes. The parallels between Samson and Heracles or Hercules. Mm. Yeah, because they're both sort of these strong men. And the very, you know, they're the traditional 10, oh my gosh, not 10 challenges, 10 feats that Hercules had to perform as penance. And his very first one was killing a lion, which is just kind of crazy because of what's about to happen here in chapter 14, where Samson kills a lion. So anyway, it was doing some reading on Heracles this morning and came across that parallel here with Samson. Anyway, what happens? Well, a lion is going to be a lion and a woman are part of this this next story. A riddle, a lion, a woman, a riddle, some honey, all kinds of interesting things coming up. Well, Samson grows up and he goes looking for a wife, is what this next story is about. He goes down to Timnah, which is about 6 miles away from where he lived. And there he saw one of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, I will say one thing before we move on. This verb for went down, yarad, does seem to be kind of a thematic part of this particular section of his life, because it occurs 5 times in the next couple chapters. So Samson keeps going down, just like, you know, Jonah does the same thing. Goes down to the shore, goes down to the ship, goes down into the ship, goes down into the heart of the sea. So we have this descent. And the same thing is happening here with Samson. But he goes down to Timnah. And he came back and told his father and his mother that he has found Mrs. Wright. I saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, therefore, get her from me as a wife.
Different times, man. Different times.
He doesn't even say you talked to her.
No, just yeah. Saw her.
Saw her.
Went back to mom and dad, said, I know what I want for Christmas. And that was it.
Wrap her up and put a bow on her. That's the one I want. So his parents are not too keen on this idea. They say, Samson, is there no woman among the daughters of your relatives or among all our people? The daughters of our relatives.
I was about to say, also, different time.
Yeah. Not something I'm going to say to my son. Can't you find a wife from family reunion?
Yeah, it's like Rebecca, a mother who hates one son because he won't marry his cousin.
Very different times. So, yeah, can't you find a woman from our relatives?
Yeah, what about the family reunion? You didn't see anything there that was...
Yeah, nothing really attractive. Or among our people, that you go and take a wife from the... Oh, here we come. This is the slanderous accusation, the uncircumcised Philistines.
Dude,
I learned this morning that in the Old Testament, the only ones that are called this are the Philistines.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's always like the uncircumcised. If it's never like the uncircumcised Ammonites or some other people group. Probably because a lot of the people groups actually did practice circumcision. Not all of them, as evidenced by the Philistines, but circumcision wasn't just like an Israelite thing. It was practiced by lots of different people groups. How do we know this? Because there are reliefs on the walls in Egypt, for instance, where it shows Semites, people from this part of the world. And I mean, they are portrayed graphically enough to where you can tell that in fact they are circumcised. So it was practiced by various people groups, but not the Philistines. They are the uncircumcised Philistines.
Yeah, I cannot hear uncircumcised Philistine without this. This is what pops in my head and will for like my entire life. So my dad used to always do this. He took this from lifted this from the Bible, and I just remember we used to live way out in the country, and our dog used to like always get ticks on it. Almost every night, it would seem like he was like de-ticking the dog, running around and stuff. So the dog would be sitting there, and he'd be pulling a tick, and when he'd pull a tick out, he would he'd pull it off, and then even like a tweezers, and then like kill it, squeeze it till it died. Yeah. And every time he'd pull one off, and he'd be like, "Die, you uncircumcised Philistine!" And he'd be squeezing this tick every time.
That is great. I love the stories about your dad. They're the best. That's awesome. If you're going to insult something like a tick, that's a great insult. I mean, that's just, you can't get much more biblically insulting than that. So, the uncircumcised Philistines. So Samson's response, and we'll end here. It's a little bit different in translation than in Hebrew. My translation has "get her for me, for she looks good to me." I usually like New American Standard, but I don't like it here for two reasons. First of all, the first word in the sentence, the word that is put forward for emphasis, is the word for her or she. So we might translate it not "get her for me," but like, "She is the one." So he's saying, no, I'm not going to get some other girl from my fellow Israelites, but she, this Philistine girl, is the one. And the translation "she looks good to me," I think is a little bit misleading, because in the Hebrew, it's the same kind of phraseology we're going to see in chapter 17 and 21. Remember where it says that this was a time there was no king in Israel and everyone did what was right in their own eyes.
Yeah.
That's the same phrase used here.
Yeah. In the ESV, it says, Samson said to his father, "Get her for me, for she is right in my eyes."
Yeah. 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 That's the same kind of phrase that's used here. Because I think when it's translated, "she looks good to me," I mean, it kind of comes across as a little bit like almost too negative towards Samson. Like he killed like a you know, a knuckle dragger walking around, you know, ugh, get her, she looked good. That's not what it's saying here. He's saying that she is right in my eyes. Now what he meant, we don't know. I mean, was she hot? Was there some other quality about her that was attractive? We really don't know, but whatever it was, she's the one for Samson. So she looks right in his eyes. But you can't hear that phrase though without also kind of going to those other two verses in Judges and realizing, yeah, this is not good. This is a setup for a bad series of unfortunate events that they're about to fall, at which we will have to wait, save for next time.
All right. Yeah. Next time we find out that God is afoot. He's being sneaky.
Yes, he is. Causing problems.
That's it. All right, guys. Well, thanks for hanging out. Go check out all the other content that we're making in this time so that you can, you know, have something to do. Maybe even just something to distract you from all the other things that are going on. Turn off the news for 5 seconds and, you know, get into the Bible. That wouldn't be a bad idea. Chad, I will see you next week.
All right. See you then.